talking about how these things work to start talking about how to evaluate. It's the second part of three parts in the class. Then, so the third part, in case you're wondering, is what can we do with it? Right? So the idea is that we're going to search text, which is what we've been talking about so far, is exceedingly boring, right? We can go search text on Google right now. So we want to actually use these ideas to do other things. Text has just been a convenient sort of device for teaching the idea of how things work. Right? So we're going to pull out all the text processing parts and throw in something different and build a device that does something different. So that's the third part, what can we do with them? But tonight we get to how do we know how well this works? That's first thing. Second thing we're going to do is that while I'm talking, none of you are going to be paying attention because you're all going to be trying to figure out how to post your homework. Right? It's perfectly fine with me if you post your homework after class, right? So if you're getting distracted and getting this stuff uploaded from here as a pain in the neck, it's fine if you do it after class. So please do it by the end of the day. The third thing is we're going to form project teams. And so at the end of class, we'll have a project team discussion within your team about who's going to do what role and stuff like that. Now, I need to warn you that it's not going to come out the way that I thought, because I thought there would be a few people doing weird stuff, and then there'd be one team doing each of the other three things. But that's not going to happen. One team had somebody on it that said, I'm going to do this project that you came up with, I came up with, whether or not I let them. Right? They would, if I didn't make it a group project, they'd do it as an individual. That's all there is. So I said, okay, fine. Looks like we're going to have one of those. Okay. So then the second thing was, everyone in the class said they wanted to work on expertise. And I'm like, oh, looks like we're going to have a little bake-off then, because we have two expertise teams. And we're going to see who made the best expertise location system. Get the competitive juices flowing here, right? So I'm not going to make half those people go do NASA just because I think NASA's cool, right? Everybody gets to do an expertise location system. And just to get the competitive juices flowing a little bit further, I went out and hired a graduate assistant, and they're going to make a third one that you can compare your sister to. No, seriously, got a graduate assistant working on this who will help you, all right? It just won't tell you what the other team is doing. So we're going to have a problem. We're going to have to divide up into two teams. So we'll get together as a group of 12 or 13 or 14 people, and then we'll sort of cleave down the middle and divide so that roughly half of the programming talent and roughly half of the evaluation talent ends up on each side. And rather than my, you know, sort of picking them alphabetically, I figured it'd be easier to just get them on the corner of the room and do that. And then the two teams can go off and do what they're supposed to do, which is good. And then Alistair came up with a project he wanted to do that attracted like a third of the class is now working on his team. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So we'll go around and we'll talk about what each person that's not doing a team project is able to do. And you can at that point jump ship from your team. Before you find out who they are. What's that?
I'm not sure on my team.
Very good. Okay. Now, start with questions from last time? Or questions from the homework? Did we get the whole questions answered? Are you all like exceedingly comfortable with what happened in the homework?
We'll let you know after the result.
Okay. Exceedingly comfortable?
You tell me.
But you feel like you got the idea, like you weren't wasting your time, that it gave you a chance to dig into the concepts? David feels like he's wasting his time.
No, I'm just having a bad math flashback. My history
makes it
for a reason.
So tonight, morning. Do you want to delay the inevitable with questions? No. Okay. So, we'll talk about three things tonight. evaluation in general, and then system-centered strategies for evaluation, and then user-centered strategies for evaluation. We'll spend more time tonight talking about system-centered strategies than anything else. So, information retrieval is a fundamentally, the word's up there, empirical discipline. It is an experimental science. The way we know we did good information retrieval is we measure how well what we did worked. It's not like art. You can't look at it and say, ooh, I kind of like those retrieval results. The retrieval results are better or worse in ways that we can characterize. And there are limits to our ability to characterize them, and those limits turn out to be the limits to our ability to make better systems. Because the way that we make good systems is we cook up an idea, and then we test it to see if it works. And it should be obvious why we have to do that, because when we come up with an idea in the first place, it's a stupid idea, right? Our first idea is, let's just count the words. And then we say, hey, let's see the most clever way we can use those word counts. It's like, well, counting the words are pretty stupid, right? So I was having a discussion with one of the people in the class earlier today, and he was saying, well, why don't we just make the machine understand what the words mean, and then couldn't we do that much better? And I'm like, well, yes, except that first part would be pretty hard, making the machine understand what the words meant. So maybe we could come up with a way of doing it. I'm not saying nobody will ever come up with a better technique, but the technique we have now, we say, let's just count the words, and then let's do as well as we can with those counted words. So your intuition on what the best way to use counts of words is isn't guaranteed to be correct, and in fact, if you try it out in your project, you'll find out almost certainly that it's wrong. Things you thought would help actually hurt. And then it's interesting to figure out why they hurt and what you should have done. And there are some principles. We don't lack for principles, right? Like, high term frequency is good, but how much higher is how much better? We don't really know that, right? Adjusting for document length is good. Is adjusting for it using the cosine measure better than using the Okapi measure? I don't know, but we could run a side-by-side competition and find out. So that's what we're gonna do today. So here's a basic idea that we use to make information retrieval better. We formulate some research question: is A better than B? Then we design some experiment that we can use to answer the question. Then we perform the experiment, usually making one of them some system we already know, right? So that we're not asking, you know, is something I've never tried better than something else I've never tried? It's like, you know, well, if they're both awful, I'll find out that one of them is better, but it won't really help me. So we take whatever the best we have now is, some control condition, and we try some experimental condition in comparison. Then we look at the results from our experiment, and we try to answer the question, what can we conclude about the hypothesis that we formed? So if we have a hypothesis that system B, the experimental system, is better than the control system, then we look at the results and we say, do these show that it's better? Right? Now that would seem simple, you just look at the number and see if it's better, but it will turn out that it's complex. Okay, so we have to verify that what we've learned is something reliable, and then we report the results, and that becomes somebody else's baseline for the condition, which they then try to improve. And so this is the basic idea of one piece of information retrieval research, which is the evaluation-guided research paradigm, right? And it's about making better and better and better systems. Now, if I asked you, if you liked a particular system, you might tell me, well, I don't like it because it didn't find what I wanted. I wanted something, I tried to use it to find something, I couldn't figure out how to do that. Maybe it can find it, but I don't know how to use it to find it, or maybe I read everything and I still can't figure it out. So it's not a very effective system. Or alternately, I might give you a very effective system, like I explained to you, Boolean queries are perfect. So, no problem on effectiveness, right? So what else might you want? Well, you might want something that that novices can use easily. So you might say, well, your Boolean queries, they may be very nice, but we don't know how to formulate queries. They're not very usable. So usability is different from effectiveness. And then it may well be that I have a system that has a very nice representation of the meaning of language. It just takes 15 minutes to give me an answer to anything, and so it might be more effective, but not very efficient. Right? So what we want is we want systems that are effective, efficient, and usable, and we're going to need very different evaluation metrics for all of them. So we'll concentrate today on effectiveness, because if you think about it, if I took one of them away, which one would be failing? Nice, usable, efficient system that does nothing useful. Well, that wouldn't be good. So we're going to have to get effectiveness, and then we can have a discussion about usability and efficiency and all those other things, right? So what we normally measure is effectiveness. Now, in effectiveness, there are at least two levels I can look at this at. I could say, I want to know how well the system works. So if I ask it a question, I'd like the right answer. I'd like the best document. Alternatively, I could say, I'd like to know how well, when I put a user in front of the system, they can find an answer. That's not really a question about the system. It's a question about a larger system that includes a user and machine. So where I draw that boundary has a lot to do with what kind of evaluation techniques I'm going to use. So we'll spend a lot of our time talking about system-centered and then user-centered evaluation towards the end. Efficiency, we'll simply mention now that there are a whole bunch of different kinds of efficiency issues. And usability will come up at the end where we start thinking about human benefit. So the system-centered strategy where I want to focus initially. So here's how it works. I'm given a set of documents. I'm given a set of queries. And there exists a set of relevance judgments, but you're not told what they are. I mean, think about it. It'd be awfully easy to build good systems if we knew the relevance judgments, right? But we wouldn't need a system if we knew which things were relevant. So you don't know the relevance judgments, but they exist. I give you the queries and the documents, and you produce the results. Then I build an automatic scoring system that will take these relevance judgments and compute the score for any system you can imagine making. You make as many systems as you wish to try. I'll tell you the scores for every one of them, and you can pick the one with the best score. Okay? Now let's say we're going to do this with Google. Right? So I'm going to make a new search engine called Giggle. Right? And I will show you that Giggle is better than Google. So you take your query, you type it into Google. I'll take your same query and we'll type it into Giggle. And I'll give you a result set and I'll claim that my results are better than yours. What would that mean? Now remember, there's no usability in this. There's no efficiency in this. I just want to look at two sets of results from the same queries on the same documents. What would it mean for me to do better? Yeah. So in Google, I can keep clicking the next page for as long as I like until my finger gets tired, right? I can keep doing that in Giggle too. So they both give all the relevant documents and a whole lot of other trash.
But the relevant ones are, you find them first in Giggle.
Okay, so if Giggle puts all the relevant documents first and Google puts all the relevant documents last, you'll buy from me, right? Everybody would agree. That's not going to happen, right? Google's going to have some mixture of relevant and non-relevant documents, and so will I. Yes?
Which mixture is better?
Which mixture is better? That's the question we have to answer.
If Google has less non-relevant results in the first page than you do...
Not going to happen.
Oh, why not? That's why yours would be better.
Oh, if they have less non-relevant? No, if they have...
Yeah, if they have less non-relevant in the first...
Then you buy from them.
Then I'll buy from you. Mm-hmm.
Something, I got something backwards.
Less non-relevant, which means that we have 10 results and 10, 2 of them are irrelevant in Google and 1 irrelevant in Giggle.
In Giggle, then you buy from Giggle.
Yes.
Very good. Okay, so this is, we've just invented our first evaluation measure. We'll call it precision at 10 documents. We take the rank list, we cut it off at 10, we measure the fraction that are relevant, and we declare that to be the winner, is whoever does best in the top 10. What happens if in Google you, Google wins this one, but now in Google you flip to the second page, and everything in Google is relevant on the second page. Remember, 8 of 10 were relevant on the first page. So now you have 18 out of 20. But in Giggle, we never found any more. That was it. We found 9, and we never found any more.
We're talking about recall there, right?
Well, I'm talking about precision at 20 now.
Well, it's
losing.
What's
that? Giggle loses. So Giggle wins on the first page, it loses on the second page. And maybe it'll win again by the time we get to the third page. It's sort of like a horse race, and we'll see what happens by the time we get to the end.
There must be a certain number of pages where the user would just not read.
And maybe we could give less weight to the pages way down because not many users will look at them, and we can give more weight to the pages up near the top because we can be sure that every user will look at them. Yes? And so you've just invented a second evaluation measure called average precision. Okay? So, good. So you've got the idea of what it is we're doing. Let's try to formalize it. So, as we build these measures, we're going to try to do what you were doing. Capture some aspect of what the user wants. Not every aspect of what the user wants. You were just asking me what's on the first page. But the user probably would like the top one to be relevant. That's another thing users would like, right? Or the first relevant one not to be too far down. That's another thing the user wants. So we can make up lots of them. So some aspect of what the user wants. Okay, so we can think of many, many of these. Now, it's important that it should have predictive values for other situations. So I just told you how Giggle did on one query. That's actually the only query it works for. Google, on the other hand, works pretty well for lots of stuff. And you're like, well, Giggle was looking pretty good on the first page of that one query, but not so good on any other query I could have asked, right? So we don't actually want to know the evaluation results on the queries we have. We want to know the evaluation results on the next query you're going to ask. We want our best possible estimate of Google's performance and Giggle's performance on the next query. Okay? Maybe you'll give it a different document collection. We'd like to know how it works for that, too. Maybe Giggle is optimized for sports. But next thing you're going to do is search for news. We'd also like these results to be easily replicated by other researchers. So imagine that I run this experiment, and I find out that Giggle beats Google. A bunch of documents from my friends. I ran my one favorite query. Giggle beat Google. Therefore, you should use Giggle. Well, can I have your documents? Can I have your query? Let me see if that's true. I mean, you should be able, if you want to write a white paper hawking your product, you should be able to say, here's well-known data available to everybody that we tested on. You don't want to have something that is, you know, nobody can replicate it. That's not science. Okay, so that's another thing we like. And here's the hard one. This is the one that's really going to drive us nuts all night. We want one number. When the number is bigger, the system's better. Now, you could give me, oh, here's how it works on the first page, here's how it works on the second page, here's how it works on this query. Here's what worked on that query. I could go further. Here's what worked on that document. Here's what worked on this other document. And so we could be doing that all night. But then, I've got no idea which one to select. So I have to decide in advance what kind of comparisons I want to make and build those into my measure. And when I do, this is an important point, that expresses my values, right? It expresses what it is I care about in selecting a system. I build that into the measure. And then I can just look at the number. But if I just look at the number without thinking about what I did, it makes no sense. Now, let's say that I come up with two numbers that are different. My system, by this average precision number, gets a 0.36 gigahertz. Google, on the other hand, gets a 0.359999999. What do you want to know? Is it a meaningful difference? Meaningful to who?
To your measure. What's the margin of error?
I don't know. That's a different question. The margin of error says, is it an accurate measurement, right? I mean, so if this is 0.359999 plus or minus 0.1, you know, the other one's 0.36 plus or minus 0.1, you'd say, well, those are the same number, right? We just can't see the difference. But that's not the same as meaningful. What's meaningful? What's important, relevant's going to get us in trouble tonight, but what's important to the user, right? So if let's take precision at 10. Let's say that I have a system that gets a precision at 10 of 0.3. I should have a system like that. And another one that gets a precision at 10 of 0.5. Well, then the user will see 5 good things on one of them in the top 10 and 3 in the other, and they can probably tell the difference. Right. So that's going after meaningful improvements, depends on what the user is doing, but the statistical reliability is a different question and an important one. Okay, so these are rank lists. And I'm sorry to do this to you, but it's the way the slides are built. They run from left to right. Now, I'm not really sorry about that. What I'm sorry about is the next one runs from top to bottom. Right? So they're labeled, right? So you can just kind of get the idea. List A, list B, list C. Which list do you like better? Why do you like A better? What's that? They're neatest?
Everything you need is together. Same, similar items.
Okay. How many good documents are in the first 7 in A?
7.
7, all 7, right? How many good documents are there in the list with the largest number of good documents?
7.
Then you can't beat A, right? A is really good. But if this one had 8, well, then you'd have to make a choice, right? Maybe that one, maybe this one. Certainly not any of the others. Right? Because if they're only 7, you might as well take this one. But if you really needed number 8, maybe this list is the one you wanted. Okay, so that's essentially what we're going to try to come up with, a number to express. So we'll try it again on this one. So now the R's are relevant, like the greens before, and the blanks are not. Which one do you like better? What's that? You like G the best?
No.
No?
Someone said H.
Somebody said you like H the best? What's that?
I personally like G.
You like G?
Yeah.
Why? What's so good about G?
I like the fact that they're grouped together. I would look at A and I was like, that's interesting, just every other document. But with G, they're all grouped together. So maybe I can do another search from after looking at G.
I like
G.
Okay, so that's a reason for preferring G. Who likes something else and argue in favor of it?
I like
G. Hold on, here. I'm in favor of G because by the time you've read down to 7 documents, you've found 5 relevance.
And that's not true anywhere else.
And that's better than any of the other ones.
And you think you'd probably stop someplace around
Yeah, most people do. Yeah, okay, so G's got some advantages. Anybody want to try another list?
E.
A?
I like A.
Okay, what do you like about A?
The south side control, and then, you know, the other ones are too far away. What's the search engine getting?
Even though you're on the left side of them, it's more motivation, more, you know.
Okay, I'm still looking for the complete answer here. Keep trying.
Now I'm on the spot. Well, I was interested in H because there are six, which is the highest number, I think, and they start higher up in the list than any of the other six.
Okay.
So I get more for my, for, you know, for my money in sort of the earlier, the higher results.
I would say E is the top three answers give me my results. I don't need to go six queries, five queries, all the time.
Very good. So, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I like A because I know when I'm done, or so it seems, so I have a pattern. And then when I get to the bottom, I say, there are no more good answers.
Ooh. Yeah, the distribution of A is.
Yeah.
Psychologically, what?
I'm just imagining myself using A. I'd be more optimistic about being a little deeper, but I don't have a sense of what it is.
A kind of brings you along, right? And you've got a feel for how it's doing, and it doesn't shock you, but it does something different. Okay. So,
what question are we asking? Because the
that's the answer.
Only getting three, like, okay, I've got three right away. That's great. I don't need more than three. Well, that depends on the question you're asking or who is asking it.
Yeah, absolutely. It also depends upon whether those three relevant documents at the top of E tell you everything you need to know. Whether there are three copies of the same document, which, you know, if it's relevant, it's relevant. So if I give you the same document three times, it's still relevant. It is actually by this evaluation means, because we don't know what you've already read. We don't know what order we're going to put them in. So we get you to give us relevance judgments, and we just keep them off to the side, and then we just stick ours in here. If your system picks a document that's relevant, it's a really weak approach to this, but certainly wouldn't be true for humans. So this is the answer to the question, which one do you like? The answer is, for what? Right? Because you can like A, D, E, or F, right? They are equally good if your question is, what's Doug's phone number? And they're relevant, they'll have Doug's phone number in them, right? You don't need another document. On the other hand, H over here surely has a bunch of good documents in it. G does, and if your question is how, you know, what do we know about the presence of neutrinos in, you know, free space, well, it'll take me a little while, right? I'm going to have to read a lot of stuff, figure out what we know and what we don't know. If the question is how much stuff has been published on X, then I want something that's predictable, that I can say, well, I'm kind of running out of X here because I haven't seen any for a while. So if the system behaves in a way that I understand, that might be better. So the answer to the question, which one do I want, is answered by what do you want to do with it? In general, we could all agree that anything that puts all the relevant documents up at the top would be better than something that scattered them around, right? But once we have several scattering them around, it gets a little hard to tell them apart.
Well, it's something like Google where the state, like the results are based somewhat on how many links are on the page. If someone clicks on a result, and a lot of people click on a result, does that factor into Google's relevance?
You mean, can I factor it into relevance if I'm Google?
Yeah.
Sure, why not?
So.
Now, I can factor it in two ways. One is I can say, well, shucks, I don't have all these relevance judgments, right? I don't know what the question is, but I know what they clicked on. So forget the relevance business. Let's just see what they click on. We'll stick that in as if they're ours. All right, we can evaluate how that works. And of course, that's a fuzzier measure, but, you know, for this, we might have 40 queries. For that, we might have 100 million users. So we might get a fuzzy measure from a lot of users.
I guess what I'm saying is, if someone queries possible.
So your question isn't really about evaluation, it's about designing better systems, right? You're like, why are we paying attention to all these terms? Why can't we put some of this implicit feedback into our systems?
In a way, I guess I
am
kind of serious.
Good. Come back in a few weeks. It'll be there. What's that?
I didn't know what's coming, but
I didn't. Well, but that's where it is. Okay. Okay, so how do we go about building these test collections that we're going to measure in this way? We have to select some representative documents. So people in the early days picked abstracts because they wanted to know how well people could search abstracts because they couldn't search anything else. That's all you could fit inside the small computers, right? They had about as much processing power as my watch does. Then these days, we have people searching things that are the scale of the entire web. So it doesn't make any sense to say, how well does my system work on abstracts when it's going to be used to search the entire web. There are things like the link structure in the web, the click behavior of the users that don't exist in a tiny collection of abstracts. So I have to get representative size, sources, topics that they're discussing. So, you know, if I do really well on sports, it doesn't mean that I'm going to do really well on blogs. Because sports is in a very formalized way. Then what I want to do is I want to go out to the space of things people might want to know about. And I want to randomly select from the topic space a set of topics. That's really very hard to do. So what I do is I go out to the people space and I randomly select a set of people. And I tell them and say, give me a topic, or I'm not like, no! And they give me a topic, right? So they write down their topic. So now I have an externalized representation, which you'll recognize as a formalized information need, right? From the hierarchy of information needs. Okay, so I get that. Then, not shown here, I have to get a query that's appropriate to that topic. So the topic is what the user wants to know about, and then the query is what the user would type in, the compromised information need. Where do I get the compromised information need if I have the topic? From the same user. It's all that's done until they query two. All right? Okay. So now I got both the topic statement, I'm going to use the topic to do relevance judgment, and I've got the query. Then we make a really stupid assumption. We assume that every document is relevant or not. There's nothing in between. It's not a little bit relevant. There's not pretty darn relevant. Every document is relevant or it's not. Lesson number one from the homework is, that ain't true, right? And who knows that better than the person trying to write down the relevance judgment or going like, this is a really stupid task, but they're paying me $10 an hour to do it, so what the hell, right? We'll just give them numbers, they seem happy. So we get binary relevance, and we get it for every topic on every document. Okay, now, how many documents are there on the web?
A gazillion.
Maybe two. It turns out you need about 50 topics when you do this to get statistical reliability. So, I don't have to check a gazillion documents. I have to check a gazillion documents 50 times, once for each topic. There's a little bit of a problem here with feasibility. But just imagine that I could do this, just as a thought experiment. So I have relationships between the topic and the document for every topic-document pair. It's a one or a zero. It's stored in some database. And when your results come back, I just take the results, throw them away and replace them with ones and zeros. And then I get something that looks like the last couple of things we've looked at. Right? Okay. You still don't believe I can get them. I can tell. Then I have to come up with some measure, which we just invented precision and tenor. Okay. Now, this relevance thing is going to turn out to be a little bit of a problem, because, well, there's really the degree or an estimate of the degree. You don't actually even know the degree. All you know is the estimate of the degree of the, well, I don't know, is it the bearing of the information that exists between the articles? I mean, you get the idea, right? Nobody really knows what it is we're assessing. So all of these things had appeared in the literature by 1975, right? And people haven't started writing, stopped writing them. So that's why we ask you to simply tell us whether it's a document that somebody interested in this topic would wish to see, independent of every other document in the collection. Yes or no? You want to see it or not? So normally we take that to mean that there's some part of the document that's useful, and we assume that if there's some part of the document that's useful, you'd be happy to have it. You might be happy to have some other documents, but you'll be happy enough to have this. Okay. So that's the overly simplified version of our now. Let me just for a moment, we're not really going to do this. Let's just assume that we build a stupid system that instead of ranking things gives you a set of documents. There's no precision to 10, it just gives you a bunch of documents. Maybe 10 documents, maybe 2 documents, maybe 300 documents. Every document it gives you must be either relevant and retrieved, or retrieved but not relevant. And there are some documents it doesn't give you that are relevant but not retrieved. And thankfully, there are a bunch that it gives you that are not relevant and not retrieved. I mean, there are only 4 possibilities, right? And if everything here didn't start with R, this would be one hell of a lot easier. Alright? Okay. So, what we want to have in this perfect world is we want to have a lot of relevant retrieved stuff and no other retrieved stuff. That would be really nice, right? And we could measure our happiness by measuring the fraction that is relevant and retrieved over the fraction that's retrieved. So this is trash, this is good. What's the fraction of good stuff out of total stuff that I got to look at? And this number is called precision. Yeah, I do the same thing, right? I mean, for like the first 2 years I was working on this, I'm like, oh, no, recall, no, precision. Okay, it's either called precision or recall, okay? So that was called precision, okay? It's how precise the search is. See the bit of genesis of the name? Okay, so where do I find recall? How much of the purple did I get? So what's that? What can I point at? This or that?
What percentage of the relevant documents were returned?
Would that be this over that?
Yeah.
That?
Relevant divided, well, retrieved divided by relevant.
Okay, so I take this.
No, sorry, relevant retrieved divided by relevant.
Relevant retrieved divided by relevant. That'd be recall. It's this over this plus that, right? And precision was this, or this plus that. Yes?
Yep.
Because if it didn't start, all start with R would be a whole lot better option. Okay, and this is called falling. And nobody much reports it, but. Yes. Okay. So, precision is how much of what was found is relevant, and interactive searchers love it. Right? Because I can look at it and tell. Recall is how much of what I should have found. I paid to use this system by, you know, letting you show me advertising or something. So you're supposed to show me all the good stuff. How do you do it then? Right? And recall is usually ignored in web search because there are so many documents talking about the same things from so many different perspectives, you don't have time to read them all anyway.
So what you need to see is enough documents. So if I show you lots of good documents, you'll be happy. That's the thought. Now, if you're a lawyer, and there's one document there that could keep your client out of jail, well, maybe it would be good if we found that one. It doesn't really matter if we find any of the others, and since the system doesn't know what's going to keep your client out of jail, it would be kind of good if we could find you everything. All right? If you're a doctor, one document there that would keep your patient alive, be good for your malpractice bills to know about that one, right?
So, lawyers, patent attorneys, and patent examiners, and doctors are really big on this. And the way in which they do it is they hire people to annotate the documents that they might need to find with every possible question that they can think of that might be asked about them. And then when you ask a question, they just match your question to all the questions and they give you back the ones that match. And that fails less often than guessing which words might be in the documents. So it's not perfect, right? And that's controlled vocabulary index. Okay? And so virtually everything published in medicine is indexed using this approach because it's a high stakes game. Okay, so if you want to do recall oriented stuff, you probably aren't in the business of just picking a few terms and hoping for that. And so we tend to do precision oriented stuff when we're doing rank retrieval. Okay. So, in case you really got turned on to formulas in the last week or so, here's the same thing in math. So precision is relevant retrieved over retrieved. Recall is relevant retrieved over relevant. Fallout is irrelevant rejected over not relevant. So it's how much of the stuff you should have ignored did you ignore? And it comes because they used to have punch cards. And they would punch out, they'd have holes at the top, and they would punch out the pieces to indicate which category something was in. And then they would stick these, have you heard this story before? Does he? Okay. So, yes, they do that, and then things would fall out. Okay, anyway, that's where the name comes from. Yeah, the 670 students are kind of going wild. Oh, yeah, finally! And used for the knitting needles. Okay, anyway, if you're an engineer, you ask a different question. You ask the question, my system was supposed to tell me this was a good document. Right? That's what it's supposed to do. In every document, I show it to it, and it either says it's good or bad, and I don't care about the set. How did it do on this document? Right? So if I do that, I can compute the miss rate. I can say, I showed it 1,000 documents, and it only missed one of them. A very small miss rate. I like the system. Right? On the other hand, your system is supposed to find only relevant documents, and so if it finds something not relevant, that's a false alarm. I mean, just think, if I had to build fire departments for every false alarm, I'd be wasting lots of money on fire departments. So we make it illegal to pull the alarm when there's not really a fire. Well, can we get our engineers to make systems that don't make false alarms? So I'd like a low false alarm rate and a low miss rate. That's what engineers want. Now, if I'm an engineer and I make a system that has a low false alarm rate and a low miss rate, what will its recall and precision be?
Precision would be high, recall would be low.
Recall would be high.
Recall
would be
high.
Yeah.
Be perfect.
Okay, if it has zero false alarm rate and zero miss rate, it will have perfect precision and perfect recall. Yes? That's what will happen. But what happens if I now start changing the miss rate and the false alarm rate? Can you compute for me what happens to the precision and recall? Yes? So, if I tell you the false alarm rate, you can compute the fallout, right? If I tell you the false alarm rate, say 1 minus the false alarm rate, that's the fallout. Yes? If I tell you the miss rate, you can take 1 minus the miss rate and get the recall. So you get the fallout and the recall just fine. Where's the precision come from? What's that? It's what?
I need to think about it some more. It was the opposite of one.
So it feels like it should be opposite of one, but it's not. So here's what's going on. The fallout depends upon, if I make this area larger, the fallout, some percentage of the not relevant. So this is the relevant, right? So if the relevant stays the same, and the collection becomes larger, so the web doesn't change in size, the people write more stuff and stick it on the web, I'm sorry, the web changes size, the number of documents on my topic stays the same. So let's say I got 100 documents on my topic, right? So this set of relevance 100, whether they're found or not, there are 100 of them. Now, if I have a collection that's only got 101 documents in it, that's a pretty easy problem, right? Every time I turn around, I find a relevant document. But if I have the entire web, that's a pretty hard problem, right? Yes? So what happens is fallout, which is what this measures, is telling you for every document in here how well you're doing, but it doesn't tell you anything about how many documents you have in here. Precision has a lot to do with what we've got. Precision and recall are user-centered, so they look only at this part, right? The retrieved part, the relevant retrieved, and the relevant part, and they ignore everything that's going on out there. So the engineers are asking, how do I do on this one? How do I do on that one? How do I do on this one? The answer is, I don't care how you did on that. Right? The only thing the user saw was this, and the only thing they cared about was this and this. Nothing else could have possibly bothered them. They don't care about the rest of it. So you get different ways of putting them together in user-centered, user-oriented measures like precision and recall, and engineering-oriented measures like misses and false alarms. I asked you to suspend disbelief for a moment and told you that there'd be a set of documents and we're just going to see how well we did so that we could draw it. But in practice, that doesn't happen. So now I have to tell you, what do I do if I give you a ranked list? Because remember, the upshot of last week was, if Doug's talking, just say ranked list and you'll be okay. All right? So here are some ranked list measures. There's the precision at a fixed number of documents. But we don't actually calculate the precision of the fixed number of documents because you're not going to give us that query again. So what we do is we calculate the average across a set of queries of the precision at that number of documents. Right? The mean precision at that number of documents. And that tells us the expected, is actually a term from mathematics, expected value of the precision. Which means if you pull another query out of the same random distribution by going and getting another person and choking them, that this is our best guess of what precision at 10 you will get for them. So we take the mean across some set of documents, the average precision at some fixed number of documents, for example, at 10 documents. Right? So we talked about that already. The expected search length is a number that we talked about. If I'm looking for one relevant document, the question is, how far down the list do I have to look? If it's 10 down the list, that's pretty expensive for me to have to look at all 10 of them to see the relevant document. But if it's in the first position, I'm much happier. So I'll give myself 1 over 1 credit when it's in the first position, 1 over 2 when it's in the second position, 1 over 3 when it's in the third position. So if it's further down the list, I start getting no credits at all, which is about what I should get, right? Now you could think about maybe there'd be other ways to compute that, but that's the basic idea. That's expected search length. Here's the here's another one that you might have thought about if you worked at it for a little while. How far down the list do I have to go to get a tenth of the relevant document? The relevant document that exists. Maybe. Depends on what? Okay, so at every position I can tell you how many relevant documents I found, and if I know how many relevant documents there are, there's some point on the list where I found a tenth of them. Yes? But since I know in my evaluation how many relevant documents there are, I can compute the precision at a recall of 0.1. Now this is a whole lot better than computing the precision at 10 documents, because if I compute the precision at 10 documents for some topic that only has two relevant documents, what's the largest value that you can possibly get for precision at 10? 0.2. So that topic cannot contribute very much, even if your system's really good. So I'm measuring how well your system does then on topics that have lots of relevant documents. But you shouldn't care how your system does on topics that have lots of relevant documents. Those are easy topics. The question is, how well does your system do when it's presented with a hard problem? All right? Everybody does well on the easy problems. Right? So precision at 10 documents has got a measurement problem sort of built into it. If you think about it, precision at a recall level of 0.1 doesn't have that problem. If there were lots of documents, I have to find a lot of them. If there aren't very many documents, I don't have to find very many of them. So it's sort of auto-normalizing. One of the best measures, the best auto-normalized measure, is the precision at the number of documents that exist, the number of relevant documents that exist. Precision at the number of relevant documents that exist. So let's say I have a topic that has three relevant documents, then I can use precision at 3. What's the highest possible value for that? 1. Yeah? Now if I have a document, if I have a topic that has 45 relevant documents, then it's precision at 45 that I can use. What's the highest possible value for that? 1. Okay? So now I'm not disadvantaging anybody. So this is called R precision, because like everything else that starts with R, R is the number of relevant documents.
You can't do that if you don't know the number of relevant documents.
You can't do any of this if you don't know exactly which documents are relevant. That was the problem with the whole thing, right?
Right.
You all didn't believe me when I told you that I went out and found for every document on the web whether it was relevant to 1 to 20 queries, or 40 queries, or 50 queries, right? That's where I got to. Yeah. I have to solve that problem, but not before the break. No. You have a question?
Okay,
you don't get the breakdown anymore.
That's really important.
Actually, precision, I can evaluate the precision of anything I want.
This is the measure of what you've retrieved.
Well, I've retrieved, and I've retrieved them, so I can look at them now. It's the recall that nobody knows.
Well, it doesn't depend on the system.
I mean,
the web knows, but it's the database of documents
that you
put in.
I'm assuming the phone number, how many. Yeah. In effect, the web, I know what I put in. If I weren't a web search company, because I crawled the web,
right.
This is what I found. Now I'll put it in.
Right.
Yeah? So you always know what the total set of documents is. The trick is knowing which ones are relevant. So your challenge over break will be to think about a technique for keeping me from having to mark every single one. But we need to get there first. What's that?
People use marketing.
Uses what?
Marketing.
Marketing?
Trust them.
Right. Yeah. It's meant to be using the stock market as an evaluation thing, right? If the stock goes up, probably it's a good search. Okay, so this is essentially what we've been talking about all night. We're going to take in a query. We've got some black box. we're taking some documents, we're going to get a rank list. We'll drop our rank list in the evaluation module, we'll put in our relevance judgments, which were gathered at great cost, and out will come our measure of effectiveness. Right? That's what we're going to do. So all I have to do is give you all those things, and the only one that's expensive is the relevance judgments. This is what a topic looks like. In the text retrieval conference, which is, you all remember when I went to Budapest? This is a bunch of people, they have these meetings in three places. Budapest, Tokyo, and Gaithersburg. Now, if somebody gave you a choice, which one would you go to? Okay, so they invented this technique in Gaithersburg, and then they copied it in Budapest and Tokyo, and so off to Tokyo we went. In May, and then Budapest in August. But actually, we'll do it the first day. So this is the way it works. Somebody gives you a short version. This is something like somebody might type into a web search engine. And then they give you a longer version, which is something like the first thing you might say to a librarian. And then they give you a really long version, which is something like what the librarian might know after asking you a few questions. This and that together are the basis for relevance judgments. This is a formalized information need. In fact, it's called a topic. And the way we get queries will seem to you to be brain dead. We take every word in here and every word in here, and we treat that as a query. We call that title plus description queries. Or we take every word in here and we treat that as the query. And we call that title queries. And the beauty of this is, if I have two systems and one of them does better, I know it's not the query that caused it, because they both got the same query. So if you come up with an evaluation technique that requires me to change the queries when I change the system, I can't tell whether it's you that I'm measuring, you the better query builder, or the system. So we're going to make this brain dead assumption that we'll all just use the same query. So let's just imagine we're using those as the queries. So here are some examples of the kinds of questions you might ask. I might have one system that has morphological analysis in it and another one that does not. So anybody remember what morphological analysis is?
Taking out
ING. I take out the INGs, but leaving things that are really roots, really words, not what stemming does, or chopping these things off. So I might be a developer of morphological analysis software, and I might say, hey, I can show my software will result in better retrieval than this simple stemming algorithm because mine's more sophisticated. And so I could run an experiment like that. Or maybe I have some thesaurus, this is actually one of the projects, some thesaurus, and I want to expand the query automatically. So I find some word that I know in the thesaurus, I'll just take all of the things in the thesaurus that are, for example, narrower terms, and automatically do an expansion. And we'll see if I get better retrieval. Right now, you should think immediately, you couldn't possibly get worse retrieval. You have more information, just you wait. Okay. So, last concept before the break. We'll do this on both sides of the break, so you get two looks at it. Here are now, again, horizontally, sorry about that, the documents. That's relevant. What's the precision at one? One over one. Now, if there are a total of 14 relevant documents, not all shown here, then what's the recall here?
114,
right? It's not hard to trigger. Okay? How about here? What's the precision? What's the precision? So what's the precision here? 2/5. Got it, right? Okay. So I can compute the recall and precision at every point along the way and plot them. And here's what it always looks like. If the top one is relevant, then I get at some recall level, so this is 1/14th in this case, I get perfection. Now, it's not necessary that I got perfection here. I could have gotten starting here if the first one had been in second position. Right? So I get, in this case, I start here, and my precision falls until I get to here. But if I go one more document, my precision and recall both increase. Now look at this. That's the answer. Look at this. Here, I go from 1/4 up to 2/5, and from 1/14 up to 2/14. Now, it's not going to surprise you, that increase, right? This cannot go down. Look at it on the graph. Every time the recall goes up, the precision goes up. Yes? Like found money. Magic. Right? I increased both my recall and my precision. People told you your entire life you can't do that. Right? But we did. You go further down the list, your recall goes up, and your precision goes up. You go further down the list, things drop, they go back up, they drop, they go back up, they drop, they go back up. They always drop vertically. As long as I'm finding irrelevant documents, my precision is going down, and only when I find a relevant document is my precision going up. So it must always look like this. Okay? So now I want to find a number that tells me how much I like that graph. Right? That's what I'm looking for. And let me give you the number to think about. The graph separates the world into two parts. The things above it and the things below it. It's a line, right? So there are the things above it and the things below it. Would a better graph have more things below it or less things below it?
More.
We'd all pay more for a graph that had more below it. We'd like it to be 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. That'd be really nice. All right? That's possible. So we want more below it and less above it. So we'll take the amount of the graph that's under here and we'll call that how good our system is. The amount of space under the graph. You make a nice high graph, you hold it up a lot, what does that mean? It means it has a high precision at every level of recall. Don't you like that? No matter what recall you want, no matter how far down the list you go, you get high precision. Right up to the time you find the last document. Yes?
The difference if you have more relevant documents initially, it could be the same graph as if you have more relevant.
You mean if they have the same area below?
Same, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So you could have C-sig graphs, you know, something like this. And you just all kind of said, well, we'd be equally high. You don't have to agree with that. But I got the class to vote with me. Right? That they were going to vote for better area, more area under the graph is better, and now you're going to show me counter. After break. Okay? So we'll try to turn this into a number when we get back. And we're going to use surely not your fault. Yeah, maybe. I just couldn't find it. So what project did you want?
The
expertise, just like everybody else. State Department campus. Perfect. Thank you.
This is shared by the
information here.
Like that. That change to the slide or pass any review for the still we are planning change.
Thank you. If I go slowly and take my time, it's a that's okay.
Okay, well, with that as prologue, what we will do in the second half of the class is talk about how to actually compute these numbers, and then we'll talk about why this is a really bad idea. Didn't expect it to be any other way, did you? Okay, so it's a little bit annoying to have to plot this sawtooth graph and then to compute the area under it. That's a kind of a difficult mathematical computation, and it's a pain in the neck. It's also not a very attractive graph because people know that as you go further down the list, the recall is decreasing. But it looks from this as if you go further down the list, the recall is kind of bouncing up and down. And that's actually what's happening as you find additional things on the list. But if you had a particular precision level that you were interested in, you could have stopped here and gotten that precision level. You didn't have to go out to here to get that precision level. Right? So if the question is, what's the earliest point at which you can get that that precision level, this would be it. So we could have drawn a line from here over to here, and then from here over there, from here over to there, from here over to there. There was no need to go any further if you were happy there. Right? So if the question is, how far down do you have to go in your rank list to get to a certain precision level, if that's your sort of frustration point, if that's where you'll stop, and the answer is, you can just take every point, draw it across, draw this a straight line across, draw this a straight line across, draw this a straight line across, and draw that a straight line across. And then you get a graph that looks like a stair step. Yeah, it's a little bit easier than to compute the area under the curve. But we don't actually even bother doing that. What we do, that's what people used to do. But what we do now, if we can get this thing to now help us move forward. Okay, and it did. Because we do this. So, we make the following very simple assumption. You will stop when you are happy. And the only thing that can make you happy is reading enough relevance documents. That's what you're trying to do. We don't know what enough is, but that's when you'll stop. Right? So, what if reading one relevant document would be enough? And what's the precision at enough? One out of one, right? What if reading two relevant documents would have been enough? Two out of five, right? Because you have to go down to five to get to the second relevant document. Maybe if you needed three relevant documents, your happiness would have been 3 out of 6. If you needed 4, it would have been 4 out of 8. 5, it would have been 5 out of 11. And 6, it would have been 6 out of 16, right? Now look, I don't know which one of those you wanted. What does it mean to say I don't know?
Because we don't know in the beginning what you wanted.
I don't know what you wanted, right? So I'm going to say there's an equal chance you might have wanted any of those. Because if I know there's a very high likelihood that you wanted this one, well, then I did know what you wanted. I didn't know it perfectly, but I knew something about what you wanted, right? If I know nothing about what you want, I don't know which one of those numbers to use. So I'll use their average. So I take the average of the precision at the possible stopping points. Figuring you'll stop when you're happy, and you're happy when you've read enough relevant documents. So I figure you never stop on a gray one. You just keep plowing ahead until you found enough, whatever enough is. Since I don't know what enough is, I'll take the average because what I'll assume is that if there are, let's say, 12 people in the class, two of them want this, two of them want that, two want this, two want that, two want that, two want that, I gotta make the same search engine for all of them. Right? Because I don't know which one they are when they come to the system. Make sense? So here's what I'm gonna do. I take this number, this number, this number, this number, this number, this number, I add them up and I divide by 6.
I'm sorry, the top number or the bottom number?
I'm going to take
Or the whole number?
1 over 1.
Okay.
Plus 2 over 5. Plus 3 over 6. Plus 4 over 8. Plus 7 over 11. Plus 6 over 16. I have all into my calculator. I'm going to get a number. I'm going to say, that's how happy the average person would be with this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Do you understand how that's the same as this?
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, where were those numbers? There's the first one, right? There's the second one. There's the third one. There's the fourth one. There's the fifth one. There's the sixth one. Right? Those are the places where you would be locally happiest on the graph. Right? Some sawtooth structure of the graph. Those are the things that are getting projected across when we do a fault interpolation, which I graphically described to you earlier. Right? These are the key points. These are the points that define how well your system is working. Yes? So, we just average those numbers as a measure of how well the system's working, which is the area under that curve, the curve joining. So, under about 2. Okay?
Do you have a lower bound?
Your precision can never be, or average precision, this number can never be lower than 0.
How far are you going to cut? So if you got a whole web, this would be quite a different proposal. If you got the whole web and you got, you know, a document that's like 1 trillion down on your list, it's actually relevant.
Mm-hmm. So, what we'll do is we'll count all the remaining documents as never having found any of the remaining 14. I'm sorry, 10. We found 6 of them, and we averaged 10 of them in at 0. Right? If there really are 20. No? Yeah, I'm sorry, if there really are 16.
Okay.
If, no.
20.
14. Sorry, 14. So the remaining 8 have to get counted in at 0 to do this one. Right? So that just takes this graph.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I think we're calling.
Got it?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the calculation again. This is the same calculation. Nothing changed except vertical. So you get 1 over 1 is 1. 2 over 2 is 1. 3 over 5 is 0.6. 4 over 9 is 0.44, and if there are only 4 documents to be found to make the graph work nicely, you would get average precision of 0.76 here, and you would be famous. Right? We rarely see numbers like this. This system, 1 out of 3, 2 out of 7, an average precision of 0.31. All right? That's just the average of those two numbers. This system, 1 out of 2, 3 out of 5, 4 out of 8. You see how to calculate this? This is pretty easy, right? Once you get it graphically like this, put it sideways and start, right? Okay. I drew these. Jimmy put the deal. I told you like these better. Okay. So, that's how we get a number, right? Now, you'll see that for different topics, we might get very different numbers. So we take the average across these topics to get what we call the mean average precision. Now those of you that study mathematics will know that the mean and the average are the same thing, right? But everybody used to call this average precision until somebody pointed out it was actually average precision. Right? Because this is the average of a bunch of averages of precision, and this is the average of average precision. And average precision just sounds stupid. Right? So somebody says, well, what's all the mean average precision? Like, then we could say math. So that's what they did. Right? Okay, now, you can look at it this way. If I plot the average precision, this is not the mean average precision, this is the average precision for one time. Right? I get some number, I don't know, 0.3 something. To another topic,
system does better. Another one, worse. A bunch more, sometimes better, sometimes worse. This is how real systems behave. This is actual real data from a real system. So, we just tell you 0.4, the buffers. Right? Of course, there were no topics that had an average precision of 0.4. It's just the average across the average precisions was 0.4.
It was one of them.
Pretty close, 0.39. See? Not 0.4. I got to draw the Yeah, it's pretty darn close. Okay, now if you took the graph that I showed you before, remember every one of these, that thing, is one of those graphs. It's the area under that graph. That's what every one of those bars is. So the bar on the far left there is the area under, I don't know, maybe this one. Right? So when we do a lot of them, we get this. As the recall goes up, the precision goes down. Yes? Okay. Now, this is one system. Okay? And this line here is the average of all those other lines. So we say, oh, look, here, this system is doing better than. Imagine we do this again, we've got some other system whose line is down there. Right? Those lines, people draw them all the time and say, oh, look, the system's better by this much. And it's like, on which query? Right? Because on, you know, you give me another system, everything will flip around. This is a really easy query. Right? I mean, somebody gave us the query. We plotted the recall and precision. The precision is darn near perfect all the way out to a recall of darn near perfect. It's like, I don't need better systems. I need better queries, man. Send me more queries like this. Right? My system loves this query. On the other hand, this is not such a good query. Right? So if you have a system like this, then it's a good one. Right? We don't want this query. So this is what you're really doing. We take all those, we fold them down to this, then we take all those and we fold them down to that, and then I say, ah, here's the number, 0.4. This is a 0.4 system. Right? So now, how much better does that 0.4 have to get before you're going to be impressed? What if I came along and I had 0.41? Mm. Ooh, okay, I'm one impressed person. 0.5? Maybe? 0.9? Yeah. Well, but I'm holding the collection of the queries constant. Are you impressed at 0.41? Why not?
Well, if you look at the space, just even within that one topic, for the different queries, they're
all over the place.
Yeah, there's the gap, like the variance.
So you don't, statistically, you don't think 0.41 is any better than 0.4. I mean, it's not worse, right? If I made you pick one, you take the 0.41 one and, you know, take it home from the store with you. Right? See how it grows up.
Are we going to talk about standard deviation now?
You want to do standard deviation?
No.
Imaginary systems to give you an idea of the impact that the colloquy we've been having on 0.41. So I run experiment one. I've got system A and system B. These are the average precision numbers for system A, and these are the average precision numbers for system B. Okay? So system A has a mean average precision, that's the average of the average precision, so 0.2. And system B has a mean average precision of 0.4. Now this is not real data. I cooked these numbers up to make a point. Okay? So if you issued query one, which system would you prefer?
B.
How about query two?
B.
Great. What's something you like better?
B.
B. Okay? Okay, let's try this. What do you like better, A or B?
B.
Pretty good. How about this one?
A.
Oh.
B.
You tell that coach about right?
A.
B.
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 B. Which one are you going to buy?
B.
You going to buy B? Depends on your query, right? Okay, so my claim is there's somebody sitting here flipping coins, and if you just say A or B, depending on whether you got heads or tails, right? There's no difference between these systems. One's better half the time, the other's better half the time. Who knows? Right? They're not different on the mean, but half the time one's better, the other half the time the other one's better, right? If you really care how much better, maybe you'll like something better about B, right? So look how good it is for these two queries. You don't want them, you better buy B. Okay. So here's how we do that. We take system A and system B, and we find out if A is bigger than better than B or B is better than A. So here B gets the plus. Now here B is a minus. Here we get a plus, minus, minus, plus. And then I ask you this question. What if I flipped a coin? What do you think the chances are you would have gotten plus, minus, minus, plus, minus, if my coin was fair? I got a coin that comes up 50% of the time. Then I tell you I got that. I ask you, did I flip my fair coin, or did I flip the coin that always comes up B? Which one did I flip? You'd be perfectly willing to believe I flipped a 50-50 coin here, right? You wouldn't have any question at all. So I can compute the probability that a random choice of preferred system gave these results. Right? And that probability is 1. Right? So I can tell you that I can achieve those results with high confidence with a system that's no different from the other system. In fact, it's the same system. I just brought the same system over and over again, right? And it's got a little noise in its results. Okay. Now, it turns out that you can also pay attention to how much better one of them is. Right? And if you do that, then you can actually calculate that it's actually not quite random. There really is a signal there. We moved away from one. If you do this computation on either this technique called the sign test, or this technique called the Carrier-Wilcoxon, which is a more sophisticated test to take the advantage of the size of the differences, and you do it for real data where you have 40 or more samples, then you can often see this number become lower than 0.05. And when that happens, people say, gosh, there's only a 5% chance that it was random noise causing the result, and there is a 95% chance or better that there really is a difference between your two systems on the next square. Right? So these are the kinds of tests that we do. So this allows us to have a great economy in communication. We report the average across the relevant documents, average across the topics. It's a single number. We compare it to another single number, and we tell you a single fact, whether P is less than 0.05, meaning that the observed difference is reliable. And so this allows us to make very compact tables that show you this system is better than that system without having to reteach the class every time. Right, and go back through all those graphs and say, see, you should like this one better than that. Right? So we don't have to argue the instances. But we can't just argue the averages. We have to also do this statistical test. With me? Okay. Well, that's sort of where we were going with the setup in the class. Now, this is the major point that I skipped. You remember when I told you to just trust me that I get the relevance judgments?
And you know how I got the relevance judgments, right? I just had every person in the world do plenty of them for me. I assigned them as homework. Right? Where do you think relevance judgments come from? Right? They come from people, and the people either have to get paid or threatened. Right? Okay. So the idea that we'll get them all is referred to by researchers as exhaustive relevance assessment, and it's referred to by assessors as exhausting relevance assessment. And people have actually done this for a collection that had 100 topics and 57,000 documents. So they did 5.7 million assessments. And because we care about consistency, we couldn't have two people do the same topic. So we had to have one person do 57,000 documents. Right? So these were undergraduates at the University of Pennsylvania who did not pass their classes that semester. Right? But we did get a test collection out of it. That's the largest exhaustively assessed test collection that has ever been built. And immediately after that, the people who built it decided they would never do it again. And they never do it again because those assessments are wrong. I mean, just think about it. You had to do 57,000 relevance assessments for homework. The first 10 would be really good. You'd be getting into it. You'd be learning something. You'd be reading the stuff. You'd be wondering why people care about this, right? I mean, whatever it was, you'd be with it. You'd be thinking, right? Can you guess where you'd be around 15,000? No. Wait a minute, wasn't that wrong? No. How much do we get paid for this? Right? Why's that comic book keep falling down? Okay. You see the problem with exhaustive relevance judgments is that they're exhausting, and so people start disagreeing with themselves. So you give the people actually run these studies. You bring them back to the next semester and you pay them to do another 57,000, right? Except you give them the same topic, which they don't remember because they didn't do the last one really. They just went, no, right? You see how the homework came out there, right? Okay. So that's not a good idea. I mean, in theory, it's lovely. It just doesn't work. And besides that, nobody really cares about collections of 57,000 documents. Anything everybody can look at, you can just look at it, right? We care about, you know, gazillions of documents, right? So this is a bad idea. Okay, so there are three other ways to do it. I'll tell you the way you do it if you're in a big hurry. Then. So this is known item judgment. So here's how you do it. You get a document. This is actually Alistair's question. You get a document, and you say, what's a good query for this document? And then you'll come up with some query. And then you're done, because, well, you know which document it was supposed to find, and we'll just measure the expected search length at that document. Now, this isn't very good, because the numbers don't average very well, but we'll just do 400 of them. So we actually had to do this, because somebody asked us to build a retrieval system for Sublime. And we said, anybody know what Sublime is? Nobody? It's the third most widely spoken language in the Philippines. And the Philippines is the third most populous English-speaking nation in the world. So English is first, Tagalog is second, Cebuano is third. Right? But Cebuano is beautiful for this because you say Cebuano people. Huh? So we had to build a search system for in 10 days. Now, building the search system for Cebuano wasn't hard, right? As you've seen, I mean, you know, look, all we do is count up the characters, right? We'll just count them instead of the word. So that part was easy. Where do you get a test collection for Cebuano? 7,000 documents, 100 topics, just hit no a lot, right? So that's probably not a good idea. So what we did was we found a set of queries for which we already knew answers. So we took the Bible and we said, okay, fine. The Bible's in Cebuano.
That's the collection. Now, where do we get the questions? So we found a Bible Trivial Pursuit game that said, you know, how many of each animal got on the ark, and you had to, you know, put in two. And it had a little answer key. And we said, that's the answer. Right? So we put in the question, and we darn well better find that one Bible verse. So the Bible verses are not. Okay. It turns out the Bible is available in just about every language, as is the Book of Mormon and the Quran. And so not a bad choice for if you want to quickly get a test collection. And so we have another item test collection that works in every language. Okay. So you can see how that would be useful. The problem is, known item evaluations will tell us if a system is bad. I mean, if a system score is 0 on that test, it's pretty bad. But if the system scores about as well as some other system, you're not going to get statistically significant differences between these systems. Right? So it can't tell the good systems apart, but it can reject the bad systems pretty quickly. So if you need a system really quickly, then it's not a bad approach. Many of you will use this in your projections. As you have to do evaluation, and you may be doing evaluation on expertise finding. How do you do that? Well, you just have somebody code every professor's expertise at the University of Maryland. Well, that was not a good idea. That would make your system unnecessary, right? So you want to have some way of coming up with a test collection. This is a really good way of saying, oh, by the way, the thing we just tried failed. Right, so for your very first day, you can try something out with this and see if it finds anything. Okay. So that's one way to build a test collection is known items. An alternative way to build a test collection, and the one that you probably should really use, is that you find expert searchers and you have them answer the question, and then you see how close your system can come to all the answers found by the expert searchers. Now, this doesn't work if you're trying to build a system for use by expert searchers, right? It's a little circular. But if you're trying to build a system for use by novices, you can say, well, how close can the novices come to being experts when using my spiffy system, you know, that knows all about synonyms and whatever else it's supposed to do. Okay? So, this is search-guided assessment, and we actually did this. We had a project, I guess you gave a talk on it here earlier today, where we wanted to find out how well we could search oral history interviews. And so we did automatic speech recognition on the oral history interviews, and we had metadata that had been prepared by human indexers, but we didn't let our system see that. No one wanted to know how well we could search just using the speech recognition transcripts. So we had expert searchers search using the metadata to find the answers to the questions, and then we could measure how well our automatic processing did by seeing how close we can come to what the expert searchers have found. Make sense? So, since in each of your teams you will have people who are expert searchers, this is a pretty good strategy. This works just as well as the most widely used technique, which is the technique I'll tell you next. So here's what everybody actually does. There's no sense assessing documents that aren't relevant, right? I mean, look, if I'm trying to find all the relevant documents, are there more relevant documents or non-relevant documents? Non-relevant documents, right? Almost any question I come up with, there are more non-relevant documents than relevant documents. So, if I want to find all the relevant documents and label them 1 and all the non-relevant documents and label them 0, it's sufficient to just find all the relevant documents and label them 1, right? I don't have to even look at the other. Right? So, I need a system that can find relevant documents. But that's what I'm doing. So we'll just use it. So, you're beginning to see where this goes now? Okay, so here's what I do. I build a system that finds relevant documents. I hope. So do you. In fact, everybody in the room builds one. We all build it differently. We don't talk to each other before we build them. And then we all drive, fly, or walk to Gaithersburg, Maryland,
on some day in November, and we compare how well our systems did. It's a competition, yes? And we get bragging rights. My system is better than your system, right? Now, who does the assessment? None of us. Some people they hire in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And what do they assess? The system, the documents each of our systems found. Now, let's just say there's some other relevant document out there that none of us found. What do you think they do with that one? They call it not relevant. But it couldn't tell the difference between us anyway. None of us found it. Right? So instead of our recall being, 45 out of 131, it's 45 out of 130. There's a systematic error in all of our measurements. So we're not going to claim the absolute number is right. We're just going to say that relative to each other, we can tell who did better. With me? This sounds a little bit like magic, right? We're getting something for nothing here? Okay. Now, if all of our systems were the same, this wouldn't really work very well. We'd all have the same blind spot. So that's why we all have to have different systems. And that's why we can't use this for speech recognition, because all the systems use the same speech recognition. So that's why we did the other technique, the not as widely accepted technique. But this technique is certifiably fair. With me? I can tell whether one system is better than another. There's just no question about it. Because I pooled all of our top-ranked documents. And then I scored everybody based on the documents in the pool.
But they can be one better than another, but they can all be bad.
Yes. I can't tell you if they're good. That's a different problem. I can just tell you if they're bad. That's excellent point. I cannot tell you if they're good. But for reasons I'll tell you in a minute, I could never tell you if they're good. So hold that. But are you with me that this is fair? Now we're going to run a little experiment. Remember I told you IR is an experimental science. So here's an experiment. We're going to take one team, the University of Maryland's submission, and we're going to imagine that they were a little late sending in their data, and they didn't make it into the pool. Now how do we do that? Well, we find all the documents that were in the University of Maryland's submissions, might have been several runs, that were not in anybody else's submissions, and we just take them out of the pool. I mean, we know what the relevant documents are from every one of these systems after they've been assessed, so we just remove all of the Maryland unique assessments. Yes? This is called unique analysis, right? So we remove the uniques for Maryland. We then score all the systems. Again, now, we remove some known documents, so everybody's score goes up, right? Because their recall isn't being penalized. Fewer relevant documents. No, they're still finding just as many because nobody else found those documents. Everybody else's scores go up a little bit. So typically this is what we get. We get a plot by average precision, sorry about the funky color, that says the system OK7AX is better and the worst system is Lutzeschel. We can't really spell Lutzeschel over here. Okay. So what we want to know is, let's say that it was this system here, INQ502, that we pull back. Right? When we pull out INQ502, everybody else's scores move up a little bit. But INQ502, they only get scored with everybody else's stuff, so they get no credit at all for finding their unique stuff now, because we just don't know it's relevant. With me? Okay. So, now what we're going to find out is, did they move down in the rankings? I mean, maybe they moved up in the rankings. We'd be really impressed. Did they move down in the rankings? And the answer is, hardly ever. It doesn't make much difference. Because there aren't that many uniques, and the uniques don't have that much effect. It's an average of an average. Right? So, this is an experience. You couldn't have known that was going to happen, but that is what happened. INQ502, you pull out all its contributions and all the other contributions from the same team. Right? As if that site didn't participate, and it doesn't move down. Every once in a while it pulls something. Okay? So, with pooled relevance assessments, I can rank people fairly, including the next people to show up. If their system is a variant of one of the other systems. If they have some completely new way of doing it, if they count up pronouns or something, and nobody counted pronouns, well, then, you know, we're not being fair to them. But if they're pretty much like everybody else, we could be fair to them. Yes?
There's all this feeling that the document topic and source remain constant. What do you mean?
So this is assuming that the documents remain constant, so we're only going to make a statement about how we did on this collection,
yeah.
And it's assuming that the topics were randomly sampled, and yes, I use exactly the same random sample in all the cases.
Okay. And the queries are constant?
Yeah. The queries come from the topics. Yes. Yes. Okay? Let's see, I've got two pending issues now. Your issue was?
That you can't tell if they're good or bad.
Oh, yes, can't tell if they're good or bad. Okay, but I can't tell if they're good or bad anyway. So I had wanted to go through and do the analysis of your own relevance assessments and to show you the amount of agreement or disagreement you had among you. And I just haven't gotten that computer yet, so I'm going to bring that to the next class. But that exact computation has been done for the assessors that are used at Trek. Now, the assessors at Trek are very highly trained. And you would think that if they were thinking straight, they would have gotten librarians. But they didn't. They got intelligence analysts. Right? Well, these are people who have information needs. And so there are lots of questions about, you know, the relative strength of the Russian and Chinese submarine forces. It's like, who cares? You know, these are like Cold War questions, right? Because, I mean, that's why they retired. They have to ask them questions like that. They don't need those answers anymore. So they came and worked for Trump. Okay. that's what happened. So
looking for a post-career after
about taking Intel.
What's
that?
Looking for a post-career after
studying
Intel
and Hillman. That's right. That's what happens. You're going to move to Cambridge first. but only for 2 months a year. The rest of the time you're going to be in Florida. Okay. So you can see here that different assessors have different opinions. So here's the primary assessor, the assessor against whose opinions are being scored, and these are the number of relevant documents. These aren't even the exact same relevant documents. This just says this person thought there weren't very many, and that person thought there were a lot more. So people have a tremendous variation in what they think is relevant. So none of this makes any sense anyway. Because if I make a good system for you, what makes you think it's going to be good for somebody else? Do I make one retired intelligence analyst happy? So we do another experiment. We do exactly this experiment, except now we say, okay, we're not going to use primary. We'll use assessor A, and we'll see if the systems come out in the same way. And if that works, we'll try assessor B, and we'll see if the systems come out the same way. In fact, no matter which assessor you use, the systems come out in the same way. The scores are different by a factor of two, but they're systematically different. One assessor is like, you know, a really easy intelligence analyst. You wanted to have him like grading your homework. And the other one is like this really hard-ass intelligence analyst, right? I mean, it's got to be right on or I don't want to see it. Right? But they actually have the same thing that's driving them. One of them is right on, the same thing. The other one is easy about it. So it turns out that any set of relevance judgments that can tell the systems apart, we'll put the systems in the same order, no matter what happens in the scores. So we really can't tell. I mean, I can just tell I made that assessor very happy. But so what? I'm not going to get that assessor using my system. But the person I get, well, they're a real pessimist, and they're always unhappy. But I can make them a little less unhappy. So I'll put the systems, they'll still like this system better than that system, they just won't like anything. And here's somebody that loves everything. But they love this one even more. All right, so I'm going to get the systems in the right order. But I don't know how to do a assessment that people will agree with, because any two people will disagree on relevance about 20% of the time, even if they're both experts on the topic. But if they're not experts on the topic, they'll be all over the map. All right? Not only that, people have really done studies where you bring the same people back and they disagree with themselves a year later. About 20%. Really. And the reason for that is, think about it. Relevance is not a fact. There's no factual basis for relevance. I see a topic, I see a document, and where does relevance exist? In someone's mind, it has no corporal existence. It's not provable. You couldn't take it to court and say, no, 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 that's not relevant, somebody else will say. Looks relevant to me. Right? Who's right? Is the question here?
No, I don't. Yeah. Just that, you're talking about berry picking early on. All kinds of factors, like learning about the topic as you read the documents to retrieve it. You
know? Changes your opinion of relevance.
Yeah.
Okay. So this has been done with correlation analysis and overlap analysis. You can see the overlap gets lower and lower. Lower as you add more people. To the point where John Wilbur from the National Library of Medicine did this, and if you had enough people, there is nothing that everyone agrees is relevant. A statistic that's used to tell whether system rankings are differing is Kendall's Tau, and numbers that are below 0.8 should make you really nervous. And these numbers are really high. So it's very little change going on in the system rankings. Okay. So the fourth assessment methodology, just to review, systems submit the top 1,000 documents. We only judge the top 100 because they have the most effect on the mean average precision score. But we judge them from every system put together in a single pool without duplicates. We order them arbitrarily so nobody can tell what system they came from. And this is important, they're judged by the person who wrote the query, because the person who wrote the query has a conscious information need and a visceral information need, and everybody else only has a formal information need. So one of the things that was causing people to disagree with, they were different people. But you want the one that actually had the information need, because that's the problem we're trying to solve. Find things for people that need to find them. We treat every unvaluated document as not relevant, and we compute the mean average precision down to 1,000 documents. So we just treat everything after that as a zero, because we're down to 1/1,000. That's a score difference anyway. Okay. So, here are all the things that you should be worried about. It's not exhaustive. It's true. It's just one person's opinion. It's true. Well, we didn't score everything. It's true. We didn't do anything for the systems that didn't participate. And it's true. And so, it doesn't matter. And a bunch of people have written papers on this, and it's a little cottage industry. And essentially, this is what happens when statistics need evaluation, right? You try to figure out whether these things make a difference by running experiments on the experiment results. Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
So let's see if we got through everything. Okay. So this is going to be really important for your project, and your interest in your project's like going up quite dramatically as you get closer to starting the project. So the evaluation measures focus on relevance, and users care about a lot of things beyond relevance. I mean, even in the automatic part, then they care about how easy it is to use and whether they can learn it, but they care about duplication, for example, which isn't accounted for here. We get three copies of the same thing, they're all relevant. Our goal is to compare systems, and so we don't really care if we get the absolute value right. We care if we get the relative values in the right order. That's the main difference, the main goal. And we use averages, which obscure an awful lot of variation. And if you believe your average, you're fooling yourself. You have to do statistical tests of reliability or plot all the data. Either way is fine. Okay. Now, That was evaluation of this person. So I asked you, who wants to work on evaluation of this part? And some of you raised your hand, right? And that's actually the easy part. Evaluating that part is hard. And what's hard is, not that it's more boxes, because we don't evaluate the boxes together, we simply evaluate the whole thing as one thing. So it's nothing more complicated than the previous small box. The problem is that users make this very complicated. So previously, the only variation we had was the system, the topic, how the topic and the system work together, and the collection. Right? Those were the sources of variation. But now, we also have learning. So I know much better how to use the system after I've been doing it for a few topics, so I really kind of hosed up the first few topics, but okay, well, we'll start over again. Well, after I've done 10 topics, I know even more. So there's a learning effect, right? The users get better over time as they learn more about how to use the system, they develop strategies. And then there's the fatigue effect. They get worse over time as they get tired. So these things are fighting with each other. So they get better for a little while, and then they get worse. And you don't really quite know what's happening here. You just know that they did differently on some topics than others. And also, there's a topic and user effect. Like, some users actually know a lot about the topic, and other users don't know much about the topic. And so it's just very, very messy. And so what we do to account for that is that searcher 1 does their first search with system A, on topic 1, then topic 4, and then topic 3, and then topic 2. Now, searcher 4 is also doing system A, but they do topic 1 first, and then topic 3, and then topic 4, and I'm sorry, topic 2 first, then topic 3, 2, or 3, 4, and 1, right? So you see, we did 1, 4, 3, 2, 2, 3, 4, 1, and then down here, the system A people are doing topic 7, 6, 1, and 4, 3, 2, 5, and 8, so we're mixing it up here, so that no topic is penalized or given extra weight by its position. It has to earn its rank. And system searcher 1 is a system A kind of guy, and then system B next. Or searcher 2 is a system B kind of gal, and then system A next, right? So it's not like, well, the second one you see is the one you like. Now, we do have to be a little careful because usually when we run these user studies, we, you know, we'll bring the users in and we'll have them sign all the forms, and then we'll say, we'll give them training, we'll say, well, we're going to compare this boring old system to this shiny new system that we just built, and we'd like you to, you know, try them both out. And then when we're all done, we give them the questionnaire and say, which one did you like? And, you know, user is there. You know, if they're ordinary people, they'll want to make you happy. And they'll say, oh, I found several things about your system that I really liked. And on the boring old system, they'll say, oh, you know, it doesn't do this and it doesn't do that. Right. So it was actually a study that was done in some time back where they brought in a bunch of users and they, this was back before computers, they just did lights. They made the lighting better. And they asked people if they liked the better lighting. And they did. And then people say, like, and it turned out what they were learning was people like to be asked their opinions. Okay. You gotta be real careful about that. Okay. So, anyway, a couple of folks in our field did a study that made them famous. This is Andrew Turpin and Bill Hirsch. And what they wanted to know was, if I did a black box evaluation, and it told me the system was better. And then I did a user study, would it tell me the system was better? So I know the system's better, because I did a, you know, it's got better mean average precision, statistically significantly, meaningfully. I mean, it's large difference, right? So they just took, you know, all the stuff that you did for homework, and that was their baseline system. Exactly, they ran exactly the system you did by hand for homework, that was the baseline system. And then they took the old copy BM.1 system, which is known to be better. And they
counterbalance them and put them in writing distance.
And the differences were not nearly as large as you liked. So they ran another study. And the differences were not as big as you would have liked. And so they took 2 years and they ran a study with 100 users. And the differences were not nearly as big as you would have liked. Now, why is this? Well, it turns out that users are smart. And if you give them a system that can be used to answer the question, they will answer the question. And if you give them another system that can also be used to answer the question, they will also answer the question. It doesn't really matter if the rank list is better in one case or another, because it's a rank list of document descriptions, and just look and see which ones are relevant, right? That doesn't, I mean, all of this counting up which things are ahead of which other things, I mean, if your system can't find anything, you probably shouldn't give that to a user.
So they did two kinds of evaluations. One of them was a recall evaluation. The other was a question answering evaluation. And so they had a system that was 18% better and by a batch run. And they did this user evaluation with it, and they found that it was 15% better, but indistinguishable statistically, 0.27. The p-value, so they can't actually discern a difference if it's there. It looks like maybe there's something. And then they said, oh, well, that's promising. Let's run another one. So they did a question answering evaluation. They found a system that was 32% better with a p-value of 0.06. It's pretty close to statistical significance. And they ran a test to see how well the users could do, and the users did 6% worse with the 32% better system.
Well, this is not close.
Okay, so that's the sort of thing you get with user stress. Here is one of the most famous user studies. This is a study run back in 1985. And here's the setup of the problem. There's a lawsuit, and it involves some sort of transit case. And they're going to use one of these new information retrieval systems, and they're going to give the lawyers the system, and their paralegals can use it, the lawyers can use it, and they ask the lawyers, what fraction of the relevant documents do you need to find? And they say, all of them. You didn't go to information retrieval school. If it weren't possible to get all of them, how many would you like to find? And they said, 75%. They said, okay. Then search until you found 75% of them, and then we will go look at all the documents. So they had 350,000 pages of documents, so you could look at them, right? We'll look at all of them, and we'll tell you how well you did. And that'll be an evaluation of this newfangled STAIRS technology, right? That's an IR system. Okay, so that's okay. Here are the answers. The average recall averaged across all the lawyers and paralegals was 20%, which is okay if the paralegals were all getting zero and the lawyers were all getting 75%, but no, they weren't the same. They were indistinguishable. So lawyers were stopping when they thought they had 75%, and they had 20%. And this comes from that how predictable is the system's behavior thing that we were talking about in the beginning of the class. Okay. And it, of course, came from a failure of imagination. The lawyers couldn't think of all the people would refer to some ideas. Okay. So, anyway, those are all very disappointing. And you're probably not going to want to do a study of one of those kinds. Because if you do, you're going to have to go get 100 users and take 2 years and prove that there's no difference between any two things you might want to compare. So, you ask a very narrow question, and you ask it with great rigor, right? And then the answer almost always turns out to be no. Okay. So the more recent trend is to say, well, look, why don't we not actually try to find out what the answer to this narrow question is? Why don't we find out what people do with our systems? And once we have some idea what people did with our system, maybe we can come up with the right question to ask Or maybe we could just skip that step and build the right system, once we saw that, you know, the thing that we're doing wasn't what needs to be done. And so there are two versions of this. One of them is qualitative user studies. And what makes this a qualitative method is that you observe what the heck is going on, and then you commune with your data. So you code it in certain ways, fit it to a theory. This is the part that scientists all kind of confused. Change the theory so that it fits, right? It's a theory discovery, and that's not as funny as it sounds. It's a theory discovery problem. And after a while, your theory matches your data, and now you have some hypotheses you can go test. Now I've got a theory, tells me what should happen. Here, let's see what happens now over here. Let's see if my theory has predictive power, right? But I have to come from someplace. So it is a principled method of doing this. And so people refer to what comes out of this as grounded theory, a theory with some basis, right? Not a you sitting around thinking, hey, what's that about? I wonder what. Gravity, right? Okay, so this is one approach. The other approach does all the same things. So the characteristic of this is rich data collection. But then once you've got it, you simply say, gee, thanks for the answer. It's pretty clear that this was a stupid decision we made. Let's not bother communing with our data for a couple of years and getting our theory in line. Let's just fix this, okay? And then we'll get a bunch more users in. Now, for this, you need to have a usability lab. And the key characteristic of a usability lab is not that it has all these measurement things of instrument, software, the eye tracker, but that it has a very thick wall of one-way glass. Because people learned early on when they were doing these kinds of studies that if you would put the developers in the same room as the people who were using the system, they would have an invariable urge to go, no, 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 this is how you do it. Which, of course, the developers knew. But it wasn't really the goal to send a developer with each newly delivered piece of software, so we wanted to know how we were doing when the developer wasn't showing you how to do it. Right? And you don't have to do that when you're doing the qualitative user study, because when you're doing the qualitative user study, the person studying it normally isn't the developer. The developer's not going to go communicate with your data for 2 years, right? They're going to go change something. That's what developers do. So it's perfectly safe to sit behind them because you don't actually like this software, right? You're trying to find out all the things that are wrong with it. Right? So if you're a developer, you need a glass wall. And so we have a usability lab that you can use for your user studies, and you probably will want to do. Okay, let's see. I can tell you more stuff, but let's just finish here. Everybody uses questionnaires. And the most common questions people ask is, how did you like it? Now, if I asked you, what did you think the predictive level of how did you like it would be to how well did it work, what would you think? You would think it would have something to do with it, right? It would say explain half the variance or something like that. But no. The how well did you like it doesn't seem to be related at all to how well did it work, right? So we have people like the condition that doesn't work as well. And so this is actually good if you're a developer, because you can run a user study, and if your system doesn't work as well, but they like it better, you report that. And if the system works better and they don't like it, you report that. Okay. So you'll often see the preference data selectively reported. Okay. And it's because people just aren't good at introspection. Okay. So what's the point? You're going to go out and build a system now. The natural thing to do when you build the system is to then make some demo slides and try to sell it to somebody, namely me. Right? I mean, that's what you would do if you were in business. Build a system and see if anybody bought it. If you're interested in buying somebody's system, if you're in my position, you'd want to run a bake-off among the
the alternate candidates. So what I ask you to do is to build a system, create a variant of your system, and compare the two. And so if you have some idea, disable that idea in your system and see if that idea helped. Right? And I'd like you to do it in two ways, if you have a full-size team. One is, come up with some way of doing an automatic, you know, is this better than that? I'm supposed to find professors with an expertise. I'll mark a few professors with some expertise, and we'll see how well we do at finding them. And then, sit a bunch of people down in front of your system, and just see how hard they laugh when you try to explain to them what it is they have to do to make your system work. Now, we were talking about this before class. This is not the way you would do it if you were going to try to actually build a system. You would do a more iterative, make a little something, test a little something, make a little something, test a little. But the common complaint of students in classes like this is, by the time I get around the first iteration, the semester's over. Right? So that's okay. We're not trying to learn how to do the iterations here. We're just trying to learn the ideas. So do an evaluation. Do, you know, one with automatically and one with users. To learn how to do evaluations, not necessarily to be God's gift to evaluation answers. Right? And what do you evaluate? The system your team's building. Why not? That's the one you're going to understand. Make sense? Okay. So we need a 5-minute calisthenic break, and then we've got 5 minutes for team formation and 15 minutes for the teams to talk, and I'll move around among each of the teams and check. The homework for this week, I believe, is due in 2 weeks, yes? For this week's material. So you should look at the homework between now and next week and come back with questions next week.
Do you next week?
Then don't do that. Take your break and I'll confirm you're correct. You lose. Okay. Do next week. Sorry. Okay, so you insist on doing safe harbor tables. And you sent me an email saying,
but I didn't bring them in.
And I almost sent you an email shortly before that saying, you know, I have one. I forgot to bring it in. But I have a pump this machine. But only one sample. But I have a working IR system in front of them that I built on that. So, you can index them, and I'll give you the code that does that.
I'll
give you the data tomorrow. This does not have all the data. You need the DD, it's 2.7. I'm going to take the data that's on here. It's as good a sample as any. Now, one of the challenges you're going to have is that everybody wants to do the expertise thing. So we're going to have to recruit somebody who wanted to do the expertise thing, which we second chose stage for. So we've got three candidates, and we'll see which of them will find out. Okay?